hello.
Hey, Jordan.
Hey.
Hey, it's Renee. How are you?
Hey, good to meet you.
Good. Guy, Jordan.
Hey, Jordan. How you doing?
Hey, good. I can hear you both loud and clear.
I remember playing Karateka on an Apple.
On the Apple II. That was my first game that I published when I was in college, and kind of my first really ambitious Apple II project that kind of paved the way for Prince of Persia.
What made you think of Karateka as the game you wanted to make?
You know, I was taking karate lessons at the time, and of course I'd seen Bruce Lee movies from the 70s. I was also really inspired by Kurosawa's film. Seven Samurai was my favorite film of all time. So I guess a big part of the inspiration was to try to get some of that atmosphere of medieval Japan into an Apple game.
Did you bite off more than you could chew?
Yeah, well, I was an undergraduate taking a full course load at the time, so I really sort of alternated between saying, okay, this is ridiculous, I've got to focus on my classes and, you know, take my exams, and I'm spending all my time programming this Apple II game, you know, when I should be studying. I'm thinking, no, I've got to finish this Apple II game. This is much more important. I can read books and take classes anytime. So I think I was sort of overloaded.
It was one of the pieces of software that really sort of inspired me to get into the career. I've been a game programmer, and now I do Mac and iOS stuff.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a very audacious, sort of over-the-top game. You brought movie making to games.
Well, it's interesting. I kept a journal when I was making Karateka on the Apple II in college, and I recently sort of pulled out those old journals and published them excerpts from them as an ebook. So it's actually kind of fresher in my mind now. You know, stuff I hadn't thought about much for the last 20 years. And what's interesting, you know, reading those old journals is I realized how much it evolved. It was a process of evolution. My first idea for Karateka was more like an arcade game. You know, I just thought, you know, try to do a karate game. And then the story, you know, the idea of doing a game that had a story kind of came a little bit later in the process. And you know, I worked on it for 2 years, and it just kept getting more and more ambitious. I was taking film classes at the time, and you know, learning about early silent filmmakers. It was really interesting to me to see like the first films that used cross-cutting and close-ups. These weren't a part of film from the beginning. This was, you know, we were just a few years into Apple II games. You know, part of what was exciting to me was to try out these techniques, to try out, you know, scrolling, you know, panning and cross-cutting and telling a dramatic story within a game. You know, until then, the games that I'd been making on the Apple were really arcade game clones. You know, I spent almost a year doing an Asteroids game on the Apple. And my sole ambition was to just do a faithful copy of Asteroids that would be as much fun to play as the arcade Asteroids was. And then I couldn't get it published because Atari kind of put the word out that they didn't want computer game publishers ripping off, you know, their IPs anymore. So that was very disappointing to me, you know, having put a year into that for nothing. This was my last year of high school. So, and then I spent a year making a game, which I called Death Bounce, which was sort of like Asteroids with bouncing brightly colored balls. So it was like, it was an arcade style game, but it was an original game. And then, Doug Carlston, the publisher of, Choplifter, sent me a copy of Choplifter, which had just come out along with a joystick so that I could play it. Suddenly the wool was lifted from my eyes, and Choplifter just blew me away because it was, a very simple, elegant, well-animated game, but it didn't have any of the trappings of coin-up games of the time. It didn't have points. You know, it didn't have saucers coming along that you had to shoot to, you know, you couldn't earn an extra life by getting a lot of points, and you couldn't play forever. It was a finite story. And when you reached the end, it was game over. You know, it wasn't game over. It was the end, like a little movie. And so that really, it was a huge inspiration for Karateka. And that I realized that, you know, this wasn't like an arcade game where you had to keep, getting the player to put in more quarters. The game could tell a story. And so, you know, at that point, Karateka kind of took its, you know, its final shape as a story game. And that's part of what was interesting to me in doing the remake now, for mobile as well, because I feel like on mobile, there are a lot of games that have that arcade style, you know, sort of infinite chasing of points addiction, which is great. But I haven't seen a lot of games that tell, you know, a small story, a story that you can experience in a single playthrough and yet still want to go back and, experience that story again and try to, you know, reach perfection.
One of the interesting things I find about the way the karate, I don't know how to pronounce it, karateka.
I always said karateka, you know, but of course, the Japanese pronunciation wouldn't have a stress on any syllable, right? It would be something like karateka.
Yeah, but you stick to your guns, which I like. Like you haven't allowed yourself to be corrected about it, which is good.
It's been very difficult because, you know, I've since found out that almost everybody else in the world calls it karateka. But we didn't have podcasts, you know, in the 80s, you know, the internet, so I really had no way of knowing how all those people out there who were playing the game were pronouncing it.
One of the interesting things, and I think one of the most effective things about the way that karateka tells a story is that there is no dialogue. It is, you know, purely visual, and the music is very important, even back in the old version.
Most games, especially most Apple II games, didn't have music. For a very good reason, that you could only play one note at a time, and you had to stop the on-screen animation in order to play a note of music. The processor couldn't do both at the same time. You know, the opening, you know, what today we would call a cutscene, the music comes at moments, you know, when the evil warlord points to the door, you know, there's a little musical riff, and then the princess walks. And then, of course, when she's walking, we can't be playing music anymore. That was, you know, just designed the scene to work around the technical limitations of what the computer could do. But I really wanted the game to have music. Again, you know, thinking of silent film and just how important music was to set, you know, a mood and, you know, convey an emotion.
When you did the remake, you made music a very central part of the game itself, the actual gameplay.
Well, I really liked the simplicity of the original game, and I even in the remake, I still thought of it as a silent movie. I mean, there's really no reason to add dialogue, although, of course, today we could, because it's such a simple archetypal story that I think it didn't need it. I thought it would be stronger to have, you know, the emotion and the story conveyed just by visuals, you know, sound and music. And of course, today, we don't have those technical limitations of the Apple II, so it was really exciting to me to work with a composer of the caliber of Christopher Tin and sort of go back and revisit that same story and even the same musical themes, but using authentic Japanese instruments and, you know, orchestrating it and weaving it into all aspects of the story, not just a few moments in the cutscenes, but into the fights, so that each fight would have a story with a beginning, middle, and an end, as well as the music telling the, you know, the story of the game.
I particularly like the way that the fights are choreographed to work with the music, in that you defend on beat, effectively.
Well, that was an idea that was really central to the remake from the beginning, because, you know, early on, you know, we asked the question, how can you bring, you know, this very simple linear fighting game, you know, up to date, you know, for modern devices. And, you know, the idea of having each fight have this back and forth cinematic flow, you know, is something that, you know, I strove for on the Apple II in its way. But in doing that today, I thought that, you know, most music in fighting games just kind of plays in the background. Whereas in movies, the music really reflects what's going on in the fight. The music creates suspense. You know, you have these sort of moments of calm. You have these moments when the hero turns the tables, and then, you know, the hero and the opponent kind of face off, and then they resume the fight. But now, it's been escalated. The music reflects that. The music also reflects when one character is losing, when the fight's getting closer to the end. So, you know, we couldn't really do that, you know, with a standard button mashing, you know, fighting game type of gameplay, but by adopting this back and forth, sort of almost taking turns rhythm based style that we did, that gave the composer the ability to know what was happening in the fight, and so that the music could reflect that, and that was something that hadn't been done, you know, before in a game in that way, and that was an exciting challenge, you know, for the composer, you know, as well as, you know, for the whole team.
you feel like you're part of the story because of the way that the music's playing and the way that you have to interact with the screen and the way that everything is on beat.
Like you're playing an instrument and not just a game.
That's a great way of putting it. Yeah. You really feel involved in it.
You know, speaking of instruments, of course, one other thing that we changed in the remake is that this is now a story of three heroes all trying to rescue the princess. And of course, part of the reason that we did that was to give the game more extended playability. Whereas back in 1984, we thought it was fine that you could, you know, play a game for 25 minutes and then you lose a fight. It's the end. You then have to start over again and play the entire game from the beginning. You know, that was how a very short, simple game, you know, took us weeks to win in 1984. But, today, of course, players are used to games that are much more forgiving and that you can basically, once you start, you can pretty much continue until you reach the end. So we made this a story where it's actually quite easy to win with the strongest and ugliest of these three suitors, but to win as the true love, the first suitor who you start the game with, is the achievement of mastery that you have to, you know, be very good at the game in order to do. So that it's not hard to win. It's not hard to finish the story, but it's hard to finish it with, you know, the best ending. So this really tied in with what we were trying to do with the music, because we gave each of those three suitors his own musical instrument and his own musical theme. And of course, all of the music of the game is based on each character having their own instrument and theme, sort of Peter and the Wolf style, so that you could actually close your eyes and hear which hero is fighting which opponent. Like, even in the same fight, if you're fighting, say, the second boss, you can hear the music is reflecting the second boss's character. But then the music of the hero who's fighting him, if it's True Love, it's a flute. If it's the monk, it's a violin. If it's the brute, it's this deep contrabassoon. So you can actually close your eyes, and just from hearing the music, you can hear who's fighting who and also who's winning.
I loved that you took the idea of let's give the player three lives and then basically asked, well, why do they need to be the same person living three times? Why can't they just be three chances to win? It's such an effect. It works so well. And the way that you changed up the music, the fighting styles are different. The abilities are different. And like when you're on the third life, effectively, the brute, the game is just much more forgiving.
You're
favor of the player.
More damage. You can take more hits. And also the brute is such a brute that even if he loses a fight and gets knocked down,
gets up.
He gets back up again.
I managed to lose with the brute.
Yes, it's not infinitely forgiving. Were you able to finish the game?
I did. Yeah, that was the
playthrough. Yeah,
exactly. I still haven't won as True Love.
I haven't either.
No, it's quite hard. You know, we tried to tune it so that either on your first or second playthrough, you have a good chance of winning as the brute. Of course, you know, maybe very young players, you know, small children might take longer to win as the brute. But then to win as the monk would take, you know, more than just another one or two playthroughs for most players. And the true love is something that you might return to the game a week later and say, okay, now I'm going to try to win as the true love. It took me a while too.
It's balanced enough that you want to do it again, though. At no point did I feel like, oh, I'm never picking up this true love guy again. He's way too tough. It's always like, oh, I'm so close. I'm just one more time.
And it only takes about half an hour to play through the game from start to finish. So it's, you know, it's not a huge investment to restart the game again weeks later. It's not like the kind of long story-based game where, you know, you invest multiple sessions and hours, you know, to try to get towards the end of the story.
Over Christmas, I showed it to my sister because we used to play the original back when we were kids. She got hooked immediately. At first, she was like, I don't play video games. It's not my thing. And immediately she got into it. And actually, I was kind of pissed because I hadn't won the game yet as the monk. And as I was sitting next to her, she won. And I was like, that's my, you robbed me of my ending. But she loved it. It's got a very broad appeal.
That's great to hear. And you know, I really hope that this would be a game that would appeal to families as well, that it would be something that, those of us who are old enough to remember, the original Apple II could still share this new game with our kids, and that it would be, it's not a hardcore fighting game. It's a love story. It's got a mechanic that's very simple, but hard to master, and also very different from other games, so that, experience in other fighting games doesn't really help you, playing Karateka.
Was it a challenge to make it a mobile game? And I know that sounds weird asking you because of what you managed to accomplish on an Apple II, but now we have these giant, Mac Pros and Voodoo boxes and Xboxes and PlayStations, and you're targeting what are, again, fairly resource-constrained devices for our time.
Yeah, well, it's certainly compared to what you can do on a on an Xbox or a PlayStation, you're more constrained in terms of memory. But, we were able to pretty much squeeze in, all the graphics and certainly all of the sound and music, into the mobile version. I mean, if you look at it closely, there are atmospheric effects and, fog and leaves moving in the wind, things like that, that are simplified in, in the mobile version. But, as a playing experience, I think, you pretty much, you get the, 95% of the full thing.
And what is multi-touch like as a control for you?
Well, of course, that was another reason why the rhythm-based fighting worked so well for mobile, because the original Karateka involved a joystick and two buttons, and you had to be able to transfer that kind of control to a touchscreen. It is awkward at best. So the rhythm fighting let us have a one-touch system that was really organic to the game. So it's really about just touching the screen, tapping with the correct rhythm, rather than worrying about which part of the screen am I going to touch.
So what was this sort of the reference platform that you were designing for? Or did you even think about that? Because, the rhythm fighting will work even with a fancy Xbox controller if you just keep hitting one button,
Yes, we developed simultaneously for Xbox, PlayStation, PC, and then at a certain point in development, we then developed the iOS version.
How do you start writing a game? Like, what's your designing a game? Do you start with the story? Do you start with the mechanic?
Every project is different, but... Certainly, the mechanics should drive the story rather than the other way around. As Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, for example, of course, we knew that it was going to be Prince of Persia, so we had the world and the character, but as far as, what's the goal, who are the other characters, all of those elements were chosen to support the gameplay, which is this acrobatic fighting, running, jumping, with the ability to press a button and rewind time. So, for example, the story elements of the Dagger of Time, the Hourglass, the sand creatures, all of that came out of the fact that, we had a gameplay in which there was a button that could turn back time. So it was then a question of creating a story to justify that. With Karateka, of course, with the remake, the story came from the original game. But there again, it was a matter of, making sure that the gameplay, was in harmony with this very sort of archetypal, compact, linear story.
It seems like you treat games as their own form, where a guy like Chris Roberts may put a bunch of Star Wars style cutscenes in between, fighter missions in Wing Commander. You seem to be meshing everything up into one. Like, you want the game to tell the story rather than cutscenes.
Absolutely. I mean, look, I love movies. I love writing and making movies. But as a gamer, the most memorable and fun moments of the game are never when I'm sitting back and watching a 15-minute cutscene with lots of dialogue. I mean, cutscenes can certainly they can add a lot, when they're used correctly. But I think of them more as an element. Cinematic cutscenes are like an element in the overall experience of playing the game, and certainly not the most important element.
Which is fascinating, because I think you invented the cutscene.
with karateka. I don't know. Maybe Pac-Man got there first. Do you remember?
Oh, maybe. Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
In between levels.
The remarkable thing, though, is that how much you keep people in the game, like, across your career, rather than just, oh, your character died, here's your second life. You've always grounded it in some premise, like you can rewind time or you have a second character. The continuation of the game itself becomes part of the story.
Yeah, I always felt that, you know, when I'm immersed in a story and I feel like I'm experiencing that story in the game, if I die and then it sort of yanks me out of that into some kind of interface and then puts me back in, it breaks my emotional involvement with the story, you know, to a certain extent. So the longer that I can stay in there playing, you know, without having to, you know, come out and be reminded that yes, you know, I'm using a computer device that exists outside the world of the story. But the longer I can stay in there without a break, the more I enjoy this feeling of immersion. So that was part of the ideal, you know, that I was striving for in the original Karateka, which is why it only gives you one life. And of course, with the Dagger of Time in Prince of Persia, that gave us a way to justify why the player could keep avoiding death or, you know, undoing his own death. And in the new Karateka remake, we did that with the three suitors. So you have three lives, but they're three different lives, so it makes sense. Actually, Last Express was interesting too. That's an adventure game I did in the 90s, which is we just released on mobile as well for the first time. And there, you know, whereas most adventure games in the 90s and even now would involve, you know, saving your game. And then if you made a mistake and you died in the game, you would have to reload your saved game. Last Express gave you an interface that looked like a clock. It was like a Fabergé egg with a clock face on it. And you could actually go to that clock and rewind at any time. You could rewind to any point earlier in the game and then resume from that point. So you never really had to deal with a saved game. It was just this kind of visual interface that let you think of the game almost like your experience was almost like a videotape that you could then rewind and resume from an earlier point and play differently.
What's your opinion on modern gaming, if you have one? And I know that's a very super broad question, but I mean, did the industry go the way you thought it would when you were starting out?
Reading my old journals, I have to laugh at some of the things I was worrying about.
Right.
One thing that really haunted me while I was making the original Karateka and then Prince of Persia was I didn't know how long this would last. I thought it might be like Rubik's Cube, that computer games might be a fad, but by the time I was taking so long to make these games on the Apple that by the time I was done, there might not be a market for them anymore. So in regard to modern gaming, I think it's gotten bigger than I ever could have imagined at the time. Yet just the speed with which gaming has kind of penetrated, you know, every aspect of popular culture, and that we have so many different devices, you know, not just the, you know, the consoles that, you know, kind of represent, you know, the cutting edge technology of sound and music, that let us play games that, you know, if we'd seen them if we could have, you know, had a flash forward in the 80s and seen what gaming would become, we'd say, oh my God, it looks and sounds, you know, as good as a movie. So we have that. We also have mobile devices, which let us, you know, play not only new games, but we can still play those, these old games, these old 8-bit games that we were enjoying in the 80s, with nostalgia. Whereas at the time, it seemed that, you know, a game was something very transient that we might play it for a few months or a year, and then, you know, a couple of years later, new devices would have come out, and those old games would no longer be in a format that would no longer be playable. So I think that's probably the thing that impressed me most about modern gaming is that it's such a huge and expansive field, and that it covers, you know, old games as well as new ones. It's not like it's gone in one direction, or that one type of game has supplanted the others. They're all still here, and all, you know, constantly evolving in many directions.
What's amazing to me is I have a 7-year-old godson, and he will play Donkey Kong or Legend of Zelda or Halo or, you know, the most modern game, and they're all brand new to him. And it doesn't matter if it's an 8-bit game or an old Nintendo game or the latest Xbox game, they're all fantastic to him.
Yeah, in many ways, those old 8-bit games are actually better for kids than a lot of new games. You know, what was fun then is still fun.
And I think the constraints of the technology they had forced a sort of gameplay focus that is really engaging.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you look at those early coin-op games, Space Invaders, Asteroids, those games were hugely successful for a reason. And it's just, really, really good game design.
You are not strictly a video game guy. You do a lot of other work. I want to go with storyteller, but it seems a little bit vague.
That's fair. I mean, of course, games do tell stories, and part of what attracted me to making games, when I was in high school and college, is that, I saw it as a new medium that, that could become a storytelling medium. But certainly, I also love writing graphic novels,
right,
comics, and, making films and writing screenplays. It's been kind of an unusual, journey for the last 20 years or so, sort of switching back and forth between these different media. But I really like being able to change it up frequently. And I find that switching from one medium to another is refreshing. It definitely keeps me from getting into a rut.
I think we have a mutual friend in Adam Lissagor, the guy that did your the movie for Karateka, the ad.
Oh yeah, Adam's fantastic. He, we were looking for someone to do, a trailer for the Karateka remake, and Adam came in and talked about playing Karateka. I think it was the first game that he got as a birthday present when he was 6 years old, and he had such an emotional connection to the, to his memory of the original game, and I think that really came across in that really charming spot that he directed.
Yeah, it's a great, great spot. So when we lined up this interview, I hit him up to ask him for something smart to ask you.
Uh-oh.
He said to ask you about how film influences and works with video games, how one form informs the other.
I think if you look at the evolution of all of these forms, every new audiovisual form kind of starts out being inspired and influenced by its predecessor. When silent film was new, at the turn of the last century, the early films were modeled on stage plays. It was like the camera would be sitting in the audience and the action would be happening on stage. So all of the things that we now think of as cinematic, close-ups and, a moving camera, the expressive use of camera and sound to create effects that you can only do in movies nowhere else. All of that took years to evolve, and movies kind of came out from under the shadow of theater. I think with video games, especially in the 90s when we first had CD-ROM and, the ability to have recorded video and audio, and for the first time we could make games that contained little movies, that kind of threw games off track for a little while, in much the same way that the coming of sound kind of set back the craft of filmmaking in order to accommodate the fact that now films could have dialogue. It took a few years to kind of assimilate the new technology so that games could get back to doing those things that, that were unique to games, that only games could do. And then film, in its turn, was then influenced by video games. And if you look at, modern summer blockbuster movies, the action sequences are definitely influenced, by the video games of recent years. You compare, an action movie of 2012 with the action movies of, the 1980s, and, it's not just that the same technologies that we used to make games are now being used to make movies, CGI and so forth, but the rhythm and the types of action that are being depicted are influenced by games and the storylines as well. So I think that cross-pollination works, in both directions.
When you're writing like a film script or a graphic novel, like are you blocking off where the camera's going to be? Are you trying to, do you visualize the shot?
Every medium sort of has its own language. So it's really important to think about what you know, what's going to work well in a graphic novel as opposed to, you know, there's some sequences that, you know, if I were writing it for a film, I'd write it a certain way, thinking that because, you know, we know what, you know, what works in a film, you know, what the camera can do. If you literally took those screenplay pages and tried to adapt them as a graphic novel, you would come out with several pages of action that just would be really hard to read, you know, hard for the reader to parse. Comics and graphic novels have their own special grammar of, you know, where as our eyes move across the page, we interpret the action, we read the words. So it's really that lends itself really well to certain types of things, not so well to others. And those are different, you know, film has a kind of a different set of strengths and weaknesses. And then games, of course, as an interactive medium, you can do things that you can't do in a book or a graphic novel or a film, but that still create a special emotional effect. You know, a surprise that happens to you when you're playing, you know, for example, losing a weapon that you've been counting on, you know, that's become like a part of you, or discovering a new part of, you know, gaining a new type of mobility that lets you explore a new part of the world. You can't do that in a movie in the same way.
Is it harder to tell stories in games because of the nonlinear possibilities?
It's different. It's, you know, because a game has a story, but a game is not a story in itself. It's really, you can almost say that a game has two stories. There's the story of the universe and the characters, you know, the plot that a movie might have, but more important is the story of the player playing the game. If you're telling a friend about an experience that you had playing any game, it could be, you know, it could be Halo or it could be, you know, it could be football. Mm-hmm. You say, I was down to my last ship. There was one little asteroid moving across the screen and, I was trying to shoot it, but I couldn't get it. And then the saucer came on. You know, that's your story. That's the story of your game. And so what's interesting is when, the story that you as the player can tell of your experience playing that game meshes with the fictional story of the game universe in interesting ways. You know, that's something that, you know, the games can explore, which I think is really interesting.
It is interesting because from the game, it's almost like a movie where the writer gets his shot, the director gets his shot, and the editor gets his shot. But in the video game, instead of the editor, at the end, it's the player who gets his shot, and he's making the final version of the game that he experiences.
Yes, that's very true. That's well put. In that sense, games are almost more similar to architecture in that when you build a building, you know, you plant the trees and you put in the windows and all that, you haven't really created a finished product. It's not finished until people come into that space and start using it. And their experience of the space is what really matters.
But what you were saying was interesting because, you know, you look at, for example, Mark Miller and Brian Hitch's The Ultimates and how they told action in that story. And then you go all the way to Joss Whedon's Avengers and how that gets translated into a movie fight scene. And it's a very different language, but the effect is similar in that you're watching people. But when you're playing the game, that fist is hitting an avatar for you. It feels like you're actually involved. It's not just things you're watching, but when you mention the surprises, those surprises are happening to you and not just the people that you're watching. It makes it, you're in it, like you're experiencing it as a personal thing and not just something that you're observing.
Yeah, when playing a game, it's I think part of the unique quality of, you know, our connection with video games that we play is that we feel that it's something that's happened to us. You know, it's different from the connection that we feel with, say, Indiana Jones when we're, you know, watching a movie.
Yeah, Indy gets squashed by the boulder, but in the game, I might get squashed by the boulder.
Exactly. And the things that really matter to us when they happen to us in the game aren't necessarily the same things that we would care about most when we're watching a movie character. Different kind of identification.
One thing I find interesting is that your original games were incredibly technically advanced for the time. And many people in the industry whose success is initially predicated upon or initially have like sort of technically advanced software just kind of keep building on that. But you got away from that and started going towards the storytelling. Was that a conscious thing? Were you like, do you program anymore? Does it interest you? Was the programming just the way that you told the story? Whereas now you'll fire up, what's it called? Final Draft rather than, Xcode.
Yeah. As far as the different tools, of the trade, I always saw programming as a means to achieve an end. I mean, I loved it. I enjoyed it, but I haven't done any programming since the Apple II. I've gone more towards a creative director, writer type role. When I was making Karateka in college, I was really torn at the time because I also wanted to write. I also wanted to make movies. And, I loved what I was doing, making games, but I kind of worried that, these were two different careers and that I would have to choose one or the other. And, I sort of had that view for many years. And so I think what happened really was that the world changed and games changed. And, now we've arrived at this, this moment 20 years later when games really are just another medium of entertainment, like movies, like novels and comics, graphic novels. And somehow, we as a generation that's grown up with all of these things now kind of see them as all connected. We enjoy all of them. Whereas back in, 1984, it felt to me like, there was only a small number of people who knew about, the Apple II and, who were playing games. Now that's no longer the case. So we've kind of had this, we've sort of got this great cultural, melting pot, if you will. And that gives a lot more, I think that's created a freedom for, movies to be made, that refer to graphic novels or based on graphic novels or video games, for games, to refer to movies and TV shows, all of that, is happening now in all kinds of interesting ways.
What do you think about the business side of gaming now? I mean, back in the early days, Bill Gates very famously stood up and said, don't steal my software. And it was really just discs and sneakers. And now we've gone through a whole phase of optical discs. And now we're in the download medium where you go to the app store and games can be incredibly inexpensive. They can have in-app purchases now, but they're no longer as expensive on all platforms as they used to be. But we still want to get people like you making great games. So how do you balance the modern app economy almost with the kind of games that you want to make?
Well, there's a much larger question there too that also applies to movies and music and books. Along with the rise of the internet and mobile devices, suddenly we've got this incredible instant access to all kinds of content. Whereas in the past it was all about owning a physical copy of something, whether it was, a physical book or, a physical game. That's kind of going away. I think we're moving closer and closer to the day when you don't really need to own anything. You just have your user ID and you can pretty much, walk into your house or even somebody else's house and just expect that whatever book you want to read or music you want to hear or game or movie, you want to enjoy is going to be available to you. And, you'll get charged for it somehow. Whether it's a monthly fee or pay by use. And that's just a huge seismic upheaval in, the economy of creating art, and, the business of how people enjoy it. So, probably the music industry was the first one to be really shaken up by that. And has undergone the biggest transformation as a result. Games and movies are, we're not as far along that path, but I feel like it's heading in that direction.
Did you have a discussion about, Karateka should be, or Last Express should be free, we should do in-app purchases, we should follow a freemium model, or no, we're just going to make a fair price for the game, charge it, and people can buy it and enjoy it?
Well, that's the path that we took, but that's not to say that it's the only way to do it.
So I've worked in the gaming industry I did work for many, many years. In fact, I worked at Ubisoft Montreal. So,
oh, cool!
Thank you for your success there. got me a job. game development is kind of set up that in a sort of parallel way to the way movies are done, in my understanding. What's it like working with different teams? Like, is working with a game development team in any way similar to working with a sort of a, like a Hollywood production team?
Oh, absolutely. Making games and movies feels very similar. The big difference is that film is divided into pre-production, you know, the shoot, you know, the actual filming itself, and then post-production. A film shoot is very intense, but it only takes, you know, a few weeks or months, whereas a game production can go on for years. So I think game production, especially of a large game, you know, at a big studio, you know, like Ubisoft Montreal, is kind of unique in its combination of, you know, intensity, deadlines, and duration. You know, it's not a sprint. It's really
it's a slog.
Yeah.
Is there an environment that you enjoy better? Like,
personally, I enjoy all of them, and I find the switch from one rhythm to another really refreshing. As being part of the Disney Bruckheimer Prince of Persia movie, you know, what was exciting. I mean, to go to the desert and see, you know, hundreds of people building all these things, you know, making costumes, you know, training horses and ostriches. You know, it's a circus. It's fantastic. But then to go from that to doing a graphic novel where it's just three people, you know, me and two artists talking about it, then they draw it. That's very intimate. You know, and, you know, I think if I just had to choose one or the other of those, it would make me miss the other one. But being able to go from, you know, a movie to a graphic novel and to a larger game to a smaller game, I think makes me really appreciate the unique virtues of each type of production. And it, you know, it keeps me from getting worn out. But whereas I think, you know, working, you know, 10 or 15 years in a row, you know, sort of doing the same thing, you know, the same size project, you know, in the same type of office, you know, each has its own kind of strains.
Often we get these press releases that are incredibly technically heavy, and they tell you how many levels there are and how what technology it uses. And yours was very story driven, and it mentions Christopher Tin, the composer, and Jeff Matsuda, the designer, and it does come across as a much more artistic venture than a lot of other ones did.
Yeah, and you know, part of the appeal of the Karateka remake for me was working with a small team and doing something that, you know, we could really just focus on the creative aspects. We weren't pushing any new cutting edge technology. We weren't, you know, risking tens of millions of dollars of the studio's money. It was really just about, you know, creating a compact experience, you know, that where the team would be small enough that we could all sit around a table, you know, and talk to each other. And that was something I enjoyed.
Almost the intimacy of a graphic novel brought to gaming.
Almost. It's a, you know, the team was about, you know, about 15 people we had on Karateka. So it was a much bigger team than a graphic novel or than the original Apple II Karateka, but still a small team by gaming standards.
What's next? What does 2013 hold for you?
Well, the very next release that I'm looking forward to is actually a graphic novel. It's called Templar, and it's kind of a massive tome. It's a 480-page full-color hardcover book. It's a swashbuckling historical adventure about the Knights Templar, these crusaders who come back to France and find their order has been abolished. So it's sort of a historical, you know, romantic heist adventure, if you will. And it's, you know, it's been several years in the making. The artists, Lewin Pham and Alex Puvillon, did a really fantastic job of, you know, just creating this huge, epic, you know, medieval canvas. And it's, you know, it's a book I really love. And so that's coming out in July.
Perfect. And where can people find out about you and about all the stuff that you're working on?
I've got a website at jordanmechner.com, and I usually post, you know, when there's a new release or event or something coming up, I usually post about it there. I should mention also that I'm Jay Mechner on Twitter.
And we'll have links to all of the games and all of the books and all of the movies in the show notes for this episode.
Jordan, thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed the conversation. It's been a real pleasure.